Previously on Spodcast.
I don't know if it's a deliberate thing or not, but there's a couple of shots of the Doctor and Ruby coming out of the TARDIS into like a ruined version of London. And there's talk of there's a few shots where Earth seems to have been consumed by dust. I'm wondering, it seems like a very deliberate callback to Pyramids of Mars and Sutekh, because the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane, you know, the Fourth Doctor takes her back to her own time and shows her what would happen if Sutekh is left to run riot. That looks very similar to what the Doctor and Ruby are doing in this trailer. And I know Russell has said that it's all going to go sort of a bit gods and monsters and more into the supernatural. I'm wondering if it's possible that Sutekh is going to be in this series in some form or other.
You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality, and I bring Connor's gift of smugness to all humanity.
If you're going to be this smug the whole episode, just turn me into sand now.
Oh, I called it. I called it before everyone else called it.
Yes, you did. I was there. I was there kind of willing Fenric. And you got Sutekh. Damn it.
I think Fenric will happen. I think Fenric will happen, but I got there first.
You did.
Yeah.
So make a wild prediction for series two.
I was going to say beep the meat, but they've already done that. Frobisher, Russell T. Davies put up a penguin emoji a while ago. I think we're going to get Frobisher.
Good God, this is happening, isn't it? It really is. Should we do the theme tune now?
We get to do another Previously On Spodcast.
Anyway, previously on the Previously On Spodcast, Connor guessed that Sutekh was coming back. Roll theme. And welcome to this special episode of a podcast of spurious morality. I'm Johnston, and with me I have Connor.
I am Sutekh, god of death. I bring my dust of death and darkness to all of you incessant, vile little humans. Hi.
Hi. as you may mention a few more times over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, you did correctly predict that we were getting Sutekh in this series. And I've seen a few people on Twitter sort of quite smugly going, I guessed it, when they share a tweet from like 38 minutes into the episode. But I reckon you got there first.
I think I did. And literally from the minute I saw the title Empire of Death, I was just like, oh, that's that. Well, Sutekh's going to be in that. That's like the title just screams this is a Sutekh story. So
I'm amazed that it's not been used as a title before, actually. I did a quick Google before we started recording and couldn't find it. So I'm assuming this is genuinely the first time Empire of Death has been used in Doctor Who.
It feels like... like, you can see the target novel of this. You can see the cover with Tom Baker and Sarah Jane Smith and some lovely Chris Achilleos explosions around them. You can see, like, it's such a Doctor Who of a certain era title, Doctor Who and the Empire of Death.
If you'd have asked me, if you'd have said to me, here's the title Empire of Death, when is it being used in Doctor Who? I'd probably reply like, oh, well, it was a Hartnell episode title, and it was an NA, and it was a companion chronicle, and it was in the Seventh Doctor main range at some point, and it's been a Blake 7 as well. And like, it just seems like such a, not generic, that's not doing it justice, but obvious, I guess, obvious Doctor Who story title.
Yeah. I think is it also the most heavy metal Doctor Who title that there's ever been? Because I feel like that, it's a proper title. And there's been some weird ones this series.
The Star Beast.
Empire of Death is a Doctor Who title. It's in the same vein as the Star Beast, but goes a bit harder.
Yeah. So if you're listening at home, tweet us with what you think the most metal Doctor Who story title ever is. Robot? Badunch. Anyway, so we did an episode, about a month ago now. We discussed the first five episodes of series one. So we did Space Babies up to, was Dot and Bubble, wasn't it? And it was a nice strong, run. We were enjoying it. We had good things to say. I think that last episode went out, it might have been the day before Rogue went onto iPlayer and was broadcast. So we had a little bit of time to just kind of think about, okay, what have we had so far and that kind of thing. So we've kind of done the same. We've let the finale happen. We've waited over a week. And now we've got three more episodes plus something else to talk about. We're going to talk about Pyramids of Mars, the new version as well, but we'll get to that when we get to that. First of all, we have got Rogue to talk about. I quite liked Rogue. I thought it was perhaps the most traditional Doctor Who story that we actually got in this series. But it did have a few nice little twists in it and, you know, a few things to make it stand out and make it part of this. I think very unique series. I think series one has been very unique. I don't think it's comparable to any other Doctor Who, really, which I guess was the point of it. You know, why restart your series count if you're just going to do the same thing over and over again? I think Rogue was, there were definite elements of traditional Doctor Who in there. Certainly things that you'd pick up on that maybe we saw in Russell T. Davis's first tenure. Rogue is quite cruel, actually. I don't think this is fair. I think Rogue was a great character, but I did see someone describe Rogue as Captain Jack if you ordered him on Wish. which is a bit mean. Overall, I did like this episode. What did you think, Connor? What were your thoughts on Rogue?
I really liked it. I quite like simple, enjoyable Doctor Who, and this filled that, ticked that box very nicely, filled that niche. I think it feels most of, it feels like the most Russell T. Davies story of the bunch, because it feels, I think a lot of it comes down just the way it was made. It looks like it was nearly all shot on location. I think it just felt like a 2000. I feel like this feels like a 2006 story very specifically. I could see this fitting right into series two. Takes a lot from The Girl in the Fireplace, just in how it looks and even in some of the story. I think that was a major influence on it. I say this feels like the most Russell T. Davies story of the bunch, and it's the only one that he didn't write, or that Stephen Moffat didn't write. So that feels a bit weird, but I really loved it. It sort of flips, like, I think it almost is a reverse of The Girl in the Fireplace, where the Doctor gets this love story. And it's a gay love story. You know, it comes. It's the LGBT version of Girl in the Fireplace, to be honest with you. And that's wonderful. I think it feels good to get that story with this doctor. I'm glad that the show is wearing that very openly on its sleeve. And I think that's a very positive thing. I think Rogue's really likable as well. He's a bit like Jack if Jack was a bit rubbish. That's quite endearing. Big props to them for making him a Dungeons and Dragons player and naming himself after his class. So that gets it a big tick in my book as well. I've seen people say that the aliens are a bit naff. I love naff aliens. And it was very, very funny. The only complaint I have is that there's probably a much better role in Doctor Who for Indira Varma than this gave her. And it was a wee bit of a shame. But it's also not the end of the world. And I had an awful lot of fun with Rogue. I really liked it. I don't know how I feel about the cameo, by which I mean that face floating around with all the other faces, in the form of Richard E. Grant, and them saying it's explicitly the Shalka Doctor. I think that feels a little bit too much like a muddying of the waters for the sake of it. But fine, it's cool. We saw an alternative Doctor on screen. I can never say that's an entirely bad thing. It would be nice if they followed it up and Richard E. Grant actually did play the Doctor, because that would be the best thing ever. That's that. Shalka is canon, and I actually might have to watch it now.
Shalka is rather good, and could easily exist with... Obviously, the intention at the time it was made was that Richard E. Grant was the ninth Doctor. Like, we hadn't had Eccleston yet, and this was the first new Doctor Who with a new actor. So Richard E. Grant was the ninth Doctor for weeks. But it's never explicitly stated or anything like that. And there are various other things and situations going on in Shalka that kind of suggest it could be outside the William Hartnell turn due to Gatua timeline. I like what they've done there, because they've not done anything to sort of particularly damage continuity or change continuity. We've not had a war doctor added or another mysterious doctor added. You know, we've not suddenly made Eccleston the 11th doctor or anything like that. So I'm happy with it. Like, it's not shattered anything. It's not broken anything. The Hooniverse is still in place. And I genuinely actually hope it has some level of significance to it. Like, I genuinely hope that, as you say, Richard E. Grant's going to pop up as a doctor or something like that. Not holding my breath, but yeah, it's not something I'm against at all. I do have a soft spot for Shalka, as I said when we did an episode on it last year. But yeah, you know, I think you're right actually about it being sort of LGBT girl in the fireplace. I don't like the girl in the fireplace went for it with its ending. You know, it was sort of tied by history. Madame de Pompadour was a historical character. And I did feel kind of, I'm going to jump into the beam of light, wasn't quite as, should we say, emotionally hefty. But it certainly is a fair comparison. It certainly has some really, really, really strong points. It's a great episode. And I just love the fact that we've managed to get the outrage of the Doctor kissing somebody yet again out of certain areas of fandom, shall we say. It's like, we're still doing this. We did this in 1996, we did it in 2005, and we're still doing it in 2024. Like, wow. The Doctor kisses people, the Doctor sometimes kisses girls, the Doctor sometimes kisses boys, and maybe we all just need to accept that now. Maybe we need to move on from that one. Just saying.
I think that's the thing that a lot of people keep forgetting, is that the Doctor's not human.
and is not bound by our human, you know, the human race's strictures and morality and whatnot. And it's not even that, I mean, it's a moral or immoral thing, because obviously that's a very silly thing to say. But I just mean that the doctor is obviously not going to give a damn. Like, there's the line from Capaldi about it being about, oh, the Time Lords are 1,000 years beyond your petty human obsession with gender. And I was like, yes, they are. And that's as it should be. That's obviously, it matters absolutely not a jot to the doctor. And it really shouldn't matter to anyone who's watching it either in this day and age.
And it kind of put me, and what we've said here has kind of put me slightly in mind of how wonderfully the Liv Tanya romance was handled in Stranded. And Liv, who's obviously a character from the far, far future, just kind of went, oh yeah, is that it? And that was it. They just carried on. And it was wonderful. And that's the attitude Doctor Who should have and is probably going to have all the time moving forward now. And catch up. Seriously, if you have a problem with it, catch up, deal with it, because Doctor Who has been doing this for nearly 3 decades now. And, you know, the first Doctor had a romance. The first Doctor had a granddaughter. Like, where do you think she came from? You know, and if anyone tweets me saying looms.
Well, I was going to, it's not even looms now. It's a point of contention because of Shooty Gatwa's doctor saying that, oh, you had children. Oh, not yet. But I have a granddaughter. That's a thing again now, which we'll come to shortly.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm sticking with it. I'm sticking with there is proof that the Doctor has done romance at some point, or will do romance at some point, or whatever you want. Susan's existence is proof of that.
I think if Doctor Who gets to kiss Alex Kingston, Doctor Who gets to live the bisexual dream and kiss Jonathan Groff too. So, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it I thought it was a great episode. I really like what it did. And if you didn't, get over it, because there's, yeah. Anyway, I'll end my rant there. But yeah, good episode, really good one for us to kind of pick up the series on, I guess. You know, it's not quite the halfway point. We did do more than half before. So our next episode is The Legend of Ruby Sunday, which it was your classic Russell T Davis series finale first part. You know, lots and lots of stuff built up, lots of really big stuff, lots of mysteries that had kind of run throughout the season, kind of put front and centre. And, you know, we were invited to consider Ruby's parentage again, to consider why the TARDIS has been weird, consider the Susan Triad character and various other bits and bobs. And I thought it was just an intensely gripping setup. It wasn't perfect. It was a little bit clumsy in places, and there was slightly too much of the supporting cast of the Giggle just sort of standing around while mysteries weren't really solved, because we've still got another episode after this. But I really like what it did, and I thought the stuff in the time window, that was, you know, really sort of gripping television. That was proper can't take my eyes off this. The way it was, you know, the way it was done, the way it was performed, because obviously it wasn't performed with that surrounding by the actors. And I just thought the acting there was absolutely fantastic, and the visuals were fantastic. And there was an awful lot to like in the episode. And I, you know, it did build towards a proper sort of traditional end of part one Doctor Who cliffhanger. You know, the villain is revealed. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really, really good setup, and I think I definitely actually preferred it to what followed, which is something I would say for quite a few Russell T. Davis finales, I kind of do enjoy the part one more than the part two. But that's, you know, there's no harm there. It did what it was meant to do. It kept me gripped for a week. It kept me talking about Doctor Who for a week. And it did a damn good job of bringing back a classic villain, fairly obscure classic villain. You know, he appeared once in the 70s. But by the end of the episode, I'd kind of figured out, oh, yeah, it is Sutek then. I'd worked it out before the reveal happened. And then I heard Gabriel Wolf's voice and I went, oh, they've done it right. Like, no one else can do that. It's got to be Gabriel Wolf. And they did. They used Gabriel Wolf, who's in his 90s now and still has one of the best voices ever to grace the world of acting. So what were your thoughts, Connor?
The Legend of Ruby Sunday is one of the most gripping pieces of Doctor Who I've ever seen. I loved it. I think it's an absolute masterclass in build-up and suspense and tension. I think everyone points out the whole scene in the time window as the pinnacle of this, and I absolutely think so. It was so well made. I may be entirely wrong about this, and I'm sorry if I am, but apparently the time window was mostly practical, where Bad Wolf's technicians and engineers and special effects people had built this sort of projection to project most of the effects onto the actual set itself. I may be wrong in that, but I'm fairly sure Russell T. Davies said as much, which is absolutely phenomenal. That word. It looks incredible. The Doctor and Ruby feel properly like they're in danger in the middle of all this. I think they, it feels very tense watching them, that they can't move, and they're sort of stuck in here with whatever elemental force is in there with them. I loved Lenny Rush's character and the way he reacted to it all. He's really good. It's, you know, when he's losing control of the time window, and especially when that projection of the red and black cloud appears, his reaction to it when he can't get a reading on it, and it's hot and cold and radioactive and whatnot, and he can't understand it and he's losing his mind. He's really good. I really like Morris. And I think he's an absolutely, he's an absolute legend. So I like this little family of unit characters that we're building up, and I would love to see Morris and Lenny Rush again. It's great. I did sort of twig, so obviously whenever I was going, I was thinking, okay, this is, maybe it's real, maybe it's not real. I don't think we're going to see Sutek, but wouldn't it be lovely? When that cloud appeared in the red and black, I was going, maybe it is Sutek. Maybe I was right, and maybe this is actually going to happen. And then it went away again. I sort of thought, maybe we'll see. Don't know. Other point I love to single out is the whole build up to the cliffhanger. Then, whenever Susan Triad comes out onto the stage, and it starts building up, and you hear Gabriel Wolf's voice, I was straight out of my seat and cheering. I was absolutely thrilled that was back. I'd told my brother, is vaguely aware of a lot of things in Classic Who. He knew there was a character called Sutek. I don't think he knew much else. And I was like, that's the voice. That's the voice. It's him. It's actually him. And he's going, no, it's not. It's not. And I was like, it's the voice. It is. It's him. It's Sutek. So I was, obviously we as Classic Who fans know Sutek and we know his voice. And, you know, you then get to sit through the build up, knowing you're going to get rewarded at the end of it. And, you're getting all that wonderful stuff. You get another Harbinger drop, which I like. I like the thought of this character turning up and, you know, as soon as you ask the last name, it's just like, oh, it's going to be them. And the proverbial is about to hit the fan. So that was great. And her dialogue, listing off the gods and doing that very Russell T. Davies dialogue was incredible, listing off the different names. Some call him Set and Sithifer, and it's really, really good. I love that sort of thing. And then you get the drop on it's Sutekh, and it's just like, yes, I have been fed and rewarded as a classic Doctor Who fan that Sutekh is back. It's a moment I had been hoping for years, and you're sitting sort of watching it with this absolute disbelief, and yet the word's there on the screen, and you get a wee bit of excitement every time you see Sutekh, like literally written on the walls. So that was absolutely brilliant. I loved it. Yeah, brilliant episode, brilliant cliffhanger. How good was Susan Twist as both regular Susan Triad, but then as that really nightmarish twisted version? That shot where she suddenly looks up scared the absolute pants off me. She was superb. And yeah, loved it. Brilliant episode.
It was, yeah, particularly exceptional. I have to admit that we'd talked about Sutekh and there were rumours about Sutekh, and by the time the episode went on iPlayer, sort of the Twitter community had started to convince itself and get itself a bit excited. But even when I first heard Gabriel Wolfe's voice, and it's so distinct, you know straight away, yes, it's that voice. My first thought actually went to, what if it's the Beast now? Like, that will, like, thrill a certain generation and absolutely infuriate another.
There's a wee line in there as well, because Carla actually calls it. She's, whenever she sees the cloud in the time window, she actually says, it's the Beast. And yeah, I think that probably was a bit of misdirection. I thought for sure that they were going to draw a line between Sutekh and the Beast. I actually really like the idea that you can draw a little timeline now between Sutekh and the Beast, where you've got Pyramids of Mars, Legend Ruby Sunday, Empire of Death. And then I think whenever Sutekh gets chucked into the vortex at the end, you see him burning up. I like to think that little fragment of Sutekh that fell through the vortex and got burned up and destroyed, I like to think there was a little echo of him, ended up on Crop Tor and was the Beast, that this is a twisted, destroyed Sutekh at the end of his life.
Yep, I think that's probably something Big Finish or a novel or something will get its hands on.
I am surprised that the connection wasn't made on screen. I thought for sure that they would, but they didn't. They didn't bring that in the end, which is not a bad thing at all.
I felt for sure that they would in 2006 when they did Impossible Planet. Like, they used Gabriel Wolfe. They even made a big thing about, we've got the guy that did the voice of Sutekh. He's just got such an awesome voice. And it's like, well, those characters are so close to each other. Really, you know, they're both evil, destroy-y god things.
Can we just make it possessed Sutekh minions? Yeah.
Yeah, like, let's just make it Sutekh. And obviously they didn't. The Beast has been its own separate entity, and you know, it kind of spun off into Torchwood a bit. We had Abaddon, and there's been other references and idea, that kind of thing. So I do quite like your sort of a fragment of Sutekh, like what gets left over kind of thing. But I'm not sure. Part of me wants them to draw the line. Part of me wants them to sort of keep it entirely separate, and just like all godlike evil beings sound as amazing as Gabriel Wolfe, and we'll just leave it at that. But yeah, it was an incredibly good episode. Like you say, it was just a masterclass in suspense and tension, and you know, building up an audience, teasing them constantly for 50 minutes, and sort of hitting us with a pretty good cliffhanger and a villain that's just, you know, quite left field. You know, I suppose Sutekh is one of the more iconic Doctor Who villains, purely because Pyramids of Mars is generally well loved. But it's not, you know, he's not listed along with recurring villains, you know, Daleks, Cybermen, Ice Warriors, Sontarans, the Master, but, you know, Russell T. Davis also brought back the Macra, and I'm still slightly flabbergasted by that, even though it's been nearly 20 years. So it's not that bizarre, I guess.
I think the thing with Sutek is it's a combination of a couple of different things, because Pyramids of Mars overall is not an important story for Doctor Who. Like, it's not something that's ever been revisited before, and it hasn't really, like, it didn't really impact anything afterwards as far as, like, deep lore of Doctor Who goes, you know. But I think what Sutek has going for him, or had going for him, was excellent design work. Like, he looks incredible in Pyramids. Like, the whole mask and just the costume is iconic. Incredible performance from Gabriel Wolf, which obviously was incredible because we're bringing him back at age 91 to voice the same character. We're bringing him out of retirement, and he still does such a good job. And it's the fact that Pyramids is such a great story. And I always thought, you know, if I ever think of a major classic villain from Doctor Who that's not the Daleks or the Master or the Cybermen, usually I'll think of the Sea Devils or the Sontarans or the Zygons, and it's never very long before I get to Sutek. He ranks very highly among the list of iconic Doctor Who villains. So very, very long overdue a return, and thrilled with how they did it, that they brought back Gabriel Wolf to do the voice, and that it got such a good build up and reveal and felt like a proper, oh my gosh, this is actually happening moment. So huge props to them for that.
I also think that bringing back a villain that only appeared once before kind of, does it kind of highlight his power, highlight how serious this villain is? Like, you know, the Daleks, they do feel a bit diluted because of how often they've appeared and how often they've failed to kill the Doctor or do whatever it is they want to do, invade a certain place or whatnot. And, you know, same with Cybermen, same with Sontarans, which, you know, we have had quite a lot of comedy Sontarans now, but, you know, comedy Sontarans on screen pretty much equals serious Sontaran appearances on screen now. But the fact that the Doctor's only met Sutek once, never really met him at full power. You know, the whole point of Pyramids of Mars was Sutek is imprisoned and we're trying to release him. He never actually gets released. From that point of view, I guess he's kind of the perfect villain to bring back. It's very easy to say, this bloke you saw trapped and imprisoned in a chair for 100 minutes 48 years ago is actually the most dangerous and sinister being the Doctor's ever battled. I think that actually has an effect, that we're using a villain that's only appeared once before, which is, you know, the same reason I sort of suggested Fenric could be a good villain to use, because, again, you know, godlike creature that didn't really get to full power until 5 minutes before the end of part four. So I do think that using a villain like Sutek actually gave it a bit more of an impact. I'm really glad it was that, as opposed to, oh, it's the Emperor Dalek again, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. If they could do, you know, for Omega what they've done for Sutek, I would be a very happy fan.
Well, I think that's it, and I think that Omega has been damaged by the fact he returned in Ark of Infinity. If Ark of Infinity didn't exist, we'd all be going, oh yes, Omega's the most powerful villain Doctor Who's ever faced. And then we had Ark of Infinity, where he wasn't.
I have a slight counterpoint to that, is that I think every new Who fan who goes to watch Classic Who starts with either the Five Doctors or the Three Doctors, and we've all seen it, and no one has seen Ark of Infinity, and you can just bring him back and no one will mind.
And now you've convinced me we need to bring back Barusa. Let's have that. we've done Rassilon. Let's have Barusa.
Yeah. Will this be the fourth or fifth Barusa?
Something like that. But I think there's a book a Time War book that brings back Barossa and does something daft and gives him a bit of a redemption arc in the Time War type thing. I don't know. I need to find it and read it properly at some point. But, you know, it would be an interesting character to bring back. You know, this was my teacher, this was my mentor, this was the Time Lord that betrayed me and all of Gallifrey and all that kind of thing. There's potential there.
Was the whole thing with the TV movie, the series that was going to come after it, was the whole thing not going to be that Barossa was going to live in the TARDIS Time Rota like Superman's dad in the Fortress of Solitude and speak to the Doctor as his teacher and mentor?
Was Barossa going to be the Doctor's dad?
No. It was like... No, I think the whole thing with that series was going to be that Paul McGann was going to go and look for his dad, and Barossa would go with him, sort of as like an interface that lived in the TARDIS and he could speak to as a teacher and mentor. Something like that.
I'm very glad that series never got made. Like, I mean, part of it was let's remake a few classic stories, and as I said when we did it recently in Season by Season, like, Talons of Weng Chiang, there's an awful lot you've got to look past to enjoy it, but because of the time it was made and various other factors, yeah, I can just about look past it. What I really couldn't look past is a late 90s remake at all. And it was one of the stories that was slated to be remade.
I know, it was going to be in New York, wasn't it? Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, what, you know, instead, thankfully, we got Storm Warning and all that kind of thing eventually from Big Finish. But yeah, let's leave that one there. Before we move on to Empire of Death, which I'm told is a great jumping on point, like the rest of this series. Before we move on to that, you know, we did joke that this series is meant to be a jumping on point, and we've had about 7 jumping on points over the last year now. The finale was very much not, because as we've said, it's brought back a relatively obscure villain, well known amongst fandom, but outside of fandom, a relatively obscure villain from the mid-70s. So they kind of established the Tales of the TARDIS format before, for the 60th anniversary, and they brought it back and used it to reintroduce Sutekh and give us a new version of Pyramids of Mars with a very sort of minimal Doctor and Ruby intro and outro, which was obviously set during Empire of Death, but obviously it was on telly just before. And I thought this was great. I think this is a great idea. Like, if we're going to use a classic Who villain, let's stick the original episode on BBC Four and editing it for pace. And we all love Pyramids of Mars, but we can all accept it's got pacing issues, particularly that fourth part. And I remember watching it, the new version, I was watching through it, and got to sort of midway through part three. I'm like, I've not got a lot of running time left here, and we've not cut all that much out, really. And it's because they absolutely hacked part four to pieces, which was the right thing to do. Part four it's a rehash of the last episode of Death to the Daleks, which I'm aware has its fans, but come on, that last episode is padding, 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 padding. And they redid the padding. It's exactly the same padding. And it needed to go. And it's a much more effective story because of it. So yeah, I really liked what they did, and I was really glad that they sped up. They used the fact that they were taking sort of 25 minutes off it to speed up the finale, to speed up the end. Like, all of the build-up stuff, all of the hiding from mummies in the woods and, you know, finding explosives and various old British chaps getting killed, that's all fantastic. But it's, I think what we've learned is Sutekh is a villain that's all about the build-up. and the moment you actually get him on screen, he's less effective. So kind of not letting that padded, boring part four drag out as it does in the original is exactly the right thing to do. There were other changes made. You know, it's not like they just left it as it was and then knocked part four down to 10 minutes or whatever. There were changes. There were some nice CGI additions. I really like the use of the time vortex in the mummy case, you know, the replacement of that effect. And I really liked that, you know, some stuff was cut, some stuff that really dragged. Long shots, like there are some shots that just linger in that story just to pad out the time a little bit. And it really was well cut for pace. The only sort of weird thing for me was a random bit of Legopolis soundtrack thrown in there, which was really jarring because Dudley and Paddy Kingsland, Dudley Simpson and Paddy Kingsland were very, very different on Doctor Who, did very, very different things and do not do styles that can be meshed together in any way, shape or form. But honestly, that's my only criticism. Like, why chuck in 10 seconds of music from Legopolis when you've got a perfectly good soundtrack there already? And yeah. So what were your thoughts?
Well, just to talk quickly about the Paddy King, I didn't twig about this at the time, and I don't approve of it either. I don't think it was the right thing to do. It stuck out a mile, and it felt sort of very, oh, they're doing the reference forward to his death, because, yeah, sure. But he was talking about radio telescopes. It does tie in. I can see the logic behind them doing it. I just don't think it was necessary. It was what he was talking about. He said, you've just invented the radio telescope, however many years early, and it plays the little bit of Legopolis where he's at the radio telescope. So, it's a wee bit of a call forward. I don't know. It stuck out. I don't think it was necessary. But I can see why they did it. So yeah, fine.
You know, I hadn't made that link at all. I hadn't made the radio telescope connection. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, okay. I didn't get the reference, and judging by what I've read online, not many people did.
I didn't get it either, and it was only when I saw other people explaining it why that was there, you know, from people who did get it. But I didn't get it in the moment. It didn't stick out enough to me to connect the dots between the Doctor talking about radio telescopes and the bit of Legopolis. I just thought they put that little bit of music in, maybe to cover up a link or something. I don't know. But that's why. Yeah, I think it was a really good edit, and I'd actually watched the serial. So like the day after Legend of Ruby Sunday and the Sutek reveal, I watched the Pyramids of Mars, the four episodes back to back, and didn't twig that they were going to do Pyramids of Mars as a Tales from the TARDIS later in the week. So I watched it again on the Thursday night. I liked the edit, actually. I thought it was really well done, and I thought it massively improved, as you said, the pacing of it. There's some shots in there, like the end of part two, where the mummy's coming towards Sarah Jane in the original, is so stretched out, and you can see Elizabeth Sladen desperately trying to fill that time by moving her head around while the mummy's hand doesn't move any closer to her. In the remade version, it's about 2 seconds long, and it looks properly threatening before she manages to take it out. That whole sequence is so well tightened up just by cutting 8 seconds of footage. So that, I think a lot of the cuts that were made were very judicious and correct. As you say, they've cut part four to ribbons, and very deservedly so. I do have a friend who loves part four and thinks all the little puzzles and traps are whatnot are the best bit, and he was heartbroken, but he's wrong. The only two cuts I had any sort of problem with was whenever the Doctor and Sarah are trying to disarm the barrier, and they're sitting with that little canopic jar, and the Doctor's treating it like it's piping hot. He turns around and snaps at her. For no real reason in either version, it feels like he's very out of order when he does it, but he turns around and snaps, are you going to do anything, or are you just going to stand there? In the original, she gets a wee bit of a crack back at him about his shoes needing repairing, And then the new one, they cut it and he just snaps at her and she does what he says immediately. I think it would have been much better to leave that little line in. It's a nice wee character moment for them that she's not going to take any of his nonsense. But not really the end of the world either. What was the end of the world was the absolute cultural vandalism of taking away Sutek's bum hand from his cushion.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Cultural vandalism. It is the only thing people remember out of Pyramids. It's not Sutek. It's not Tom Baker or Elizabeth Sladen giving some of the best performances as the Doctor and Sarah. It was Sutek's bum hand and they cut it. Absolutely unforgivable. But didn't the Time Vortex
There's
look
so
lovely?
Much they could have done with that. It could have been Harriet Arbinger's hand. They could have made that a thing. Or it could have been a Susan Triad.
I love seeing like the Twitter accounts that have good name. Like there's a Sutek's bum hand Twitter account. There's the same thing on some of the forums as well. And I was reading through and there was one of these accounts going, yeah, yeah, I love this. And then dot, dot, dot. No. So
I like to think that when we get the season 13 Blu-ray, and obviously Pyramids will be on it, and obviously this version of Pyramids will be on it, I like to think that before you watch, there'll be a little menu that pops up going, you know, when it was originally cut in 2024, there was the Sutek's bum hand was removed. However, for this Blu-ray release, we present the option for you to insert the hand back in. So yes or no, would you like Sutek's bum hand? And that menu will pop up on the Blu-ray and you actually choose whether you want the hand or not.
This is a genuine scandal. This is a proper serious issue that Sutek's bum hand was cut. And I do have a genuine problem with it. So defund the BBC, cut the license fee and sack them all. Yeah.
they can take 5 seconds of Tom Baker drowning out of Deadly Assassin. They can take the scene of two people being very brutally murdered out of the Time Meddler, but Sutek's bum hand stays. As far as I'm concerned,
it's unacceptable. It's completely unacceptable. Everything else was grand. There's a little bit of a weird moment at the start where they cut original footage of the TARDIS flying through space and replace it with a shot from Shada, and then the next shot is from the original Pyramids of Mars and the TARDIS looks totally different. I don't know why they cut one and not the other, but again, not really the end of the world. So,
but also meshed up with the CGI Tales of the TARDIS version of the TARDIS as well. We had sort of three different TARDISes on screen within 5 minutes and it all looked a bit odd.
It was a good edit. I liked it. I think part four, or the part of this that was originally part four of Pyramids of Mars, is very much tighter, much tenser, and much speedier. Like, you get the sense that this is a genuine race through the pyramid. Really good. Loved that. Thought the cuts they made there were very, very justified. And they kept that lovely model shot of all the doors flipping open and seeing the TARDIS at the end. Wouldn't have been the same without that. Loved that that was still there. And yeah, the little bits with the 15th Doctor and Ruby were, they're there just because it's there as a flashback, you know, they're not essential viewing. There's nothing given away or anything like that. They're just there to bookend that this is a flashback. So it's fine. Yeah. I like the cuts they made. I like most of the changes. As you said, the new Time Vortex looks really good as the time tunnel.
Which I think is actually the first time it has looked good. Like, I don't particularly like it in the title sequence and other times it's popped up, but it looked really good there.
And do you know what I think has helped it is maybe the slightly restricted view. I got the impression that it was a little more energetic than they had done previously. And it's also seemed like they've almost... It's almost like they've shot it side on, or like they've rendered it side on to match the angle of the sarcophagus. It looks really good like that, and it makes it feel a little more dynamic, maybe. So, yeah, good.
Just one more thing I do want to mention before we move on as well was how much better the trip to 1980 was because they have stabilized.
Yes.
The footage outside the TARDIS, it just looks so much better. Like what you see out the TARDIS now actually sort of fits with the movement. Yeah, it's a little improvement, but it really does improve that sequence. Like, I've never bought that sequence in the past. I love the idea of that sequence, but I've never actually loved the execution of it. And it was just obviously a little bit too difficult for them to do back in the mid-70s. But yeah, no, well done. That did look really good and really did sort of make it the sequence it should have been.
Yes, I completely agree. It was one of the things I was looking out for to see what they did with that sequence. And it looked a heck of a lot better. It was a real improvement.
So let's return to the new series. You know, we've had The Legend of Ruby Sunday. We've had our nice little recap of Pyramids. And I actually didn't rewatch the original serial because I'd guessed that Tales of the TARDIS was going to be Pyramids, and then they did announce it a couple of days afterwards. So I kind of held off. Like, if it hadn't have been, my Thursday evening viewing would have been the four-part serial. But thankfully, I did have this wonderful new version to watch. So we move on to Empire of Death, which I'm still convinced is a companion chronicle or something. Like, how has this name never been used before? Anyway. So Empire of Death, we go into series finale territory, and I probably more often than not have found myself, as I said before, not enjoying the final episode of the finale two-parter as much as I did the build-up to it. And I think it's probably, you know, designed that way. You know, it is all in the build-up. It's all about making you talk about it and come back the next week. And it did have a lot to sort of wrap up. So Empire of Death, I enjoyed. I thought it was good. I thought it was one of the better New Who finales. I certainly thought it was one of Russell T. Davis's better New Who finales, but it definitely had some moments that weren't my favourite thing ever. It was definitely a step down from the first part. And I believe it wasn't your favourite thing ever.
No.
So yeah, moving on. That's been another fantastic series of Doctor Who. No, go on.
No, I'll be firm but kind, firm but fair. I think I came away from Empire of Death really let down. I think it's not unfair, I think, to say that it squandered an awful lot of the potential from The Legend of Ruby Sunday, which, as you say, it's all in the build-up, and then it really didn't stick the landing with Empire of Death, which is such a shame because of that title, and oh, that title deserves a better story than this. I've got a couple of problems with it, and part of it, you know, one of the elements that I have a problem with is also a problem with The Legend of Ruby Sunday, in that there's no connection at all between, or there previously hasn't been any connection at all between Susan Triad, the TARDIS feeling unwell, and Ruby's mum, and yet the Doctor arrives at Unity HQ to investigate all of these things at the same time, and they all turn out to be linked. There's nothing to set that up, that connection between them. The Doctor just decides he's going to go and solve them all simultaneously. And they all tie together here in what I think is a very unnatural way, that there was no setup that the mystery behind Ruby's mum was connected to what was going on with the TARDIS, which was connected to what was going on with Susan Triad. So that was that doesn't fit together in my mind. Beginning with Sutek, I think I'm actually not as annoyed about what happened with Sutek as I was after watching it, because yes, he gets a bit sidelined, I think, whenever the episode decides it's going to go and deal with Ruby's mum. And it does that because Sutek's confused by her. He doesn't know who she was, and there's no real reason for him not to, you know. There's no mystery there in the end. There's no magic or power or anything behind any of that. So there was no reason for Sutekh not to be able to see, you know. There's a lack of internal logic there in my mind, that all doesn't fit together. But the scenes with Sutekh are good. I like the little confrontation between him and the Doctor in the time window, whenever the Doctor, just before the Doctor summons the memory TARDIS. I think Gabriel Wolfe obviously was incredible doing that voice again. As we've talked about already, utterly delighted that he came back. And I don't even mind very much the whole... The way that they deal with him, because you get that it's a really cool shot of the TARDIS flying through the vortex with Sutekh trailing behind it. Like, that all looks really good. And you get a proper burst of excitement whenever the Doctor and Ruby turn the tables on him in Unit HQ and manage to pull, you know, get him attached to the TARDIS, and how the Doctor manages to get the TARDIS back. Again, I don't see the internal logic there behind the Doctor blowing a whistle, unless, you know, it's him, you know, that's the way he maybe taps into the whole symbiotic link between him and the TARDIS. Again, blowing a whistle removes Sutekh's influence over the TARDIS, and he's able to pull it out of his grasp because of the whistle. Why? I think there's a lot of this stuff happens for no real reason, and that's my biggest problem with it. But it looks cool and it's exciting, you know. Fine. I like the shots, as I say, of them pulling Sutekh through the vortex and the Doctor yelling at him from the doors. That's all fine and exciting, and it's a bit funny that they put Sutekh in his dog form on a leash. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, but is it Sutekh? I don't know. The whole thing with Ruby's mum, I thought, was a letdown. Don't get me wrong, it's lovely character work and it's lovely emotional viewing. But I think they put too much into it beforehand. I think they've over-egged it. And there's a comparison to be drawn here, because I think it was deliberate, and I think RTD has said that it was a deliberate reference to the whole thing with Rey and her parents in Star Wars. So the whole thing was that in Rey, yes, she was force sensitive and she, you know, could use the force and was a very powerful Jedi, etc. But they didn't build up her parents in any way. In Ruby, you know, not that they didn't build them up, there was a mystery there. But The Last Jedi sort of stripped it all back and did that little subversion where they were just ordinary people and Rey's specialness came from within her. With Ruby, they build up that her mum is some sort of mysterious being and possibly there's some power there. And that happens in a couple of ways. You get the snow first and foremost, which obviously manifests around Ruby. And I don't buy that it was just simple belief that manifested that. I don't think that works. They had the whole thing in the Devil's Cord with the secret song in Ruby that implies there's some sort of power behind her, and behind her parentage. Ruby's mum in the window, in the time window. I can't remember if she points in Church on Ruby Road. I haven't seen it for a little while. I don't remember that happening. And the Doctor says stuff in the time window scene about times changing. She didn't do that. This didn't happen. So Ruby's mum being able to change time in the window and interact with the shadow version, or the, you know, interact with the version of the Doctor and Ruby in the time window in the present day. I don't think that works. Not when you do the reveal that she's just an ordinary person and there's none of this magic actually there. I think the twist that they pulled up was not set up appropriately. I don't think it was deserved, and I don't buy it. I'm not saying that I disbelieve it and they're going to do more. I fully accept that they've said this is it for Ruby, although she is coming back, but that's maybe it for her parents, you know, her mum's storyline. it doesn't work in my mind, and I think it's a real letdown, because I haven't seen this. I haven't seen the commentary myself, but I have been told by people who have that the bit that when they say, well, why is she wearing the cloak? Because it wouldn't work otherwise if we could see her face. So they put her in a cloak. And like, again, this has happened because they want it that way and there's no reason for it. They don't. It feels like there's been a lot of corners cut, not just in this story, but across this series, where things happen because the writers or producers want to do it or want it to be that way. And that's cool, but they're not actually setting it up in the story itself. And they're not, I don't think we're getting that internal logic built up in a lot of cases, and very, very egregious here in the finale in particular. So I'll not lie, I was really disappointed, and I didn't like it very much.
And actually, it's very, very hard to disagree with pretty much everything you've just said. So what I'm going to do instead is focus on what I did like, but actually the first thing I'm going to mention is something I wasn't too keen on, which is as soon as the episode starts, it basically kills off the entire supporting cast. Kate Stewart and Rose and Morris all just get turned into sand, and that's it. And from that moment on, you know for certain that it's all getting undone.
Seconds in. Yeah. I will say, though, I bought Kate's death entirely. I was so shocked, I believed it, that they'd killed Kate. But then they also killed Carla, and they also killed the rest of the world. And it was only after that, you know, Mrs. Flood and Cherry biting the dust, and the whole supporting cast, as you say, biting the dust, that I sort of thought, okay, they actually are going to undo this. But do you see, when it was just Kate and Unit that got wiped, I thought that was it for them. I thought that they've given Kate Stewart 10 years, and that's it, she's dead. I totally bought that, and huge props to Gemma Redgrave for selling that in that scene. I thought she acted that brilliantly.
But they're never killing the Briggs daughter. They're never killing Donna's daughter. It's not happening. No.
I forgot Rose was there.
Yeah. I mean, that completely sums up Rose's role in the episode, to be perfectly honest. I don't really know why Rose was there. It's a lovely little tie back, and you know, it was really nice to have that moment, and it's nice to have a reminder of, I suppose, the old era there. And I do really hope that she does become a, shall we say, meaningful supporting character moving forward. But she was there in that purely to go, Rose works for Unit now. And that was it. I just kind of wished that there was something for them to do with her, or she just wasn't in it and would pop up later. It didn't even have to be a big role. She just needed to do something other than stand in the background. You know, there are no, you know, supporting Unit characters. Oh, okay, I'm comparing Rose to Sergeant Benton here. Sergeant Benton never just stood around and did nothing. There was always, even if it was something minor, there was always something for Sergeant Benton to do or contribute, or, you know, he'd go off on his own little side mission for half an episode and follow somebody and inevitably get clobbered or something like that. And I get they're not going to do that with Rose. Rose isn't that kind of character, but just do something. they kind of acknowledged that they didn't have a story to tell with any of these characters that had been in the first episode anymore, so they just wiped them aside. And I just thought it was a bit like, you know, imprison them, give us some scenes of them trapped inside an hourglass with a load of sand in or something like that. Just build up a bit of tension, you know. We've got to release these characters. They're prisoners of Sutek. They're his playthings. He refers to people as his playthings. Do something like that. But don't just wipe them from the episode and make it really obvious to everybody watching that by the end of it, anyone Sutek killed is going to come back. You know, the same for every character. You know, don't just kill everybody. Freeze them in sand or cover them in sand or so. I don't know. Just leave it ambiguous. The one thing I'm really, really glad they did, though, was not do that to Mel. So Mel got to become a proper companion again for the episode. She wasn't just working for UNIT. She wasn't just undercover with Susan Triad. She wasn't just a supporting character. She was one of two companions in that episode, and that was absolutely wonderful. That is exactly what I wanted them to do with Mel. I'd have been... I can take the sort of side-swiping Kate Stewart and Morris and Rose and all the other characters. I'm quite happy for them to be shoved aside if they have to be. But thank you for not doing that with Mel. It was so wonderful to have Bonnie Langford as part of the episode, doing something meaningful, fitting back into that companion role just so incredibly well. I thought that was great. I'm really, really glad they did that. And, you know, to have her kind of get eventually sort of taken over by Sutek, I thought that was really effective, you know, but it just... They gave her something to do, and I'm really glad they did, because she didn't have all that much to do in The Giggles. She didn't really have all that much to do in Legend of Ruby Sunday. But for this one, we got Mel as a companion again. And that's what we want, I think.
Yes, one of the best moments in the whole episode for me was when they have just gone into the memory TARDIS and she finds the Sixth Doctor's cravat.
Oh, the Sixth Doctor's, yes.
And that, oh, beautiful, lovely. And I like that they prioritised the Sixth Doctor there and then later went on to the Seventh Doctor and she got to cuddle his jumper for a little while as well. Lovely little callbacks. And I love that she stood there and got nostalgic for the Sixth Doctor in particular, because I love the Sixth Doctor very much. And I just thought that was lovely, and it was really heartwarming. So love that moment. I don't know. Yes, absolutely fantastic to see Bonnie Langford again. I hope we get a lot more of her. I hope she continues to pop up and sort of becomes this generation's Sarah Jane Smith, you know, in terms of popping back into the show. I liked that she was there and present. I don't necessarily like that she became a minion of Sutek, because while Bonnie Langford was very good at playing the possessed male, and very scary and threatening, I don't think they would have done it with a companion like Sarah Jane Smith, and I don't think they should have done it with Mel. I don't really like that this classic companion comes back and gets turned into a mindless minion for the bad guy.
Sarah Jane got possessed every week.
But not when they brought her back. You know, they never did that with Elizabeth Sladen in 2006 or whatever.
I mean, I've still not forgiven them for blowing up K-9. I know we had another K-9 2 minutes later, but they blew up K-9. That's not okay.
Have you seen K-9's decapitated head was on the wall in the memory TARDIS here?
Yes.
I didn't feel great about that. It would have been nice to see Mel last the whole way through instead of getting sidelined a little bit as the mindless minion of Sutek. It's okay, but they don't save her. They just sort of blast her out of the way with the TARDIS and then go off to kill Sutek, and that undoes it all. You know, there was no effort from the Doctor to save Mel in particular. He went to save the whole universe and got her as well. So, I don't know.
That's one thing that did jar me, was there was no meaningful goodbye with Mel. I get we had to wrap the whole Ruby's mum thing up. You know, I get that with the last 10 minutes had to be dedicated towards that, but... There was no, are you okay, Mel? How do you feel? And I just wish there'd been a goodbye scene, or I wish Mel had been there to see the Doctor off, or just something. She just seemed to disappear from the episode, and you know, when everything was done. And I think that Mel deserves a little bit more than that, really. She got more than that in The Giggle.
Yes.
But hopefully... It just means that she's coming back.
Yes,
and I'm going to mention it because the rumours have ramped up a little bit in the sort of few days before we've recorded this. But for ages now, there's been talk of this spin-off series, The War, was it The War Between the Land and the Sea or something like that? And the implication is it's going to be unit-based. And rumours have ramped up again in the last few days and stuff that looks so nonsensical, I'm not actually going to reference it properly, has come up on Twitter. But the fact is that I think something is coming, and I think that the way units being presented, it is setting up for something more than they're just going to pop up for an episode of Doctor Who once a year. I think that this unit team probably are getting something in terms of spin-off series.
I'm not on Twitter and don't know the nonsensical thing, so you can tell me about that after we're finished here.
Oh, right. In that case, I'm going to tell you. I am going to tell you then. Martha's in it. That's the new thing. It's come from some Doctor Who production news page that I don't think they've ever actually got anything right. Bless them.
I saw this from some page on Facebook, and the page is known for posting absolute bobbins. So I take that with salt.
I'm 99% sure it's twaddle, but that seems to be what has reignited the rumours over the last few days.
Well, I have heard a slightly different thing, and this actually comes from the mouth of Russell T. Davies himself. So the rumour has been for a while that, yes, I've heard this is going to be Kate Stewart and Mel will be involved as well. I'd heard a while ago that another character was going to be involved, and then Russell T. Davies was interviewed by the Radio Times and said he would be working with Eve Miles again fairly soon. And given that this seems to be shooting, you know, imminently, I'm taking that as an implication because I had heard that Gwen Cooper was going to be in it, and he has now said that he's working with Eve Miles again soon. I think Gwen Cooper will be in it, and I think we're going to get a unit and Torchwood crossover series.
I certainly hope so. Even the Martha thing, it would be amazing. Like, you know, I really liked Martha. I think I liked Martha as a companion more than most people did. And I did think that she was a little bit sort of hard done to as a cat. You know, Rose got the big return, and even Donna has now had a big return. And there was far more. Donna had a big return less than a year after Donna left. But, yes, Martha came back. I know Martha popped up again in Series 4 and had the cameo in The End of Time and all of that, but it kind of feels as though Martha didn't quite get the same treatment as Rose and Donna. So, I'd be up for more Martha. I'm definitely a fan of that idea. I don't think it's going to happen. I really don't think it's going to happen. I think Freema Agyeman's got far bigger acting gigs to play with. She's, you know, very successful in America now. She's been in quite a few series. It'd be nice, but I think she's just left it behind. I think if she was interested in doing more Hooniverse related stuff, we'd have got more out for a Big Finish, and she's done. Is it 4 hours of Big Finish in total?
I don't know about that as much because a big Bad Wolf produced Disney Plus series is obviously going to be of much more interest to her than an hour or two of Big Finish. I could absolutely see her doing stuff on TV, but I don't
totally,
know.
Yeah.
I don't know. The Martha stuff I don't know about. I feel more confident saying I think Gwen will be in it. Martha, I would love it. I'd love to see her again. Absolutely. Freema Agyeman's a wonderful performer. Pinch of salt with all of it, obviously, but maybe a slightly bigger pinch for Martha than for the rest of them.
I do think it's reasonable to expect some kind of spin-off series at some point, relatively, or some kind of announcement relatively soon, though, because the whole Hooniverse branding, the comments Russell T. Davies has made about this should be like the MCU and all of that sort of thing. We're going to get something. We've got to get something. It'd be stupid if we didn't get something.
Yeah.
I also suspect that they probably, obviously we've got Series 2 coming next year. We've got a Christmas special, then we've got Series 2. I suspect main Doctor Who series will have an off year in 2026, which is probably when we'll get hit by a spin-off series. Kind of make
even
up
then
for that.
Look, it'll be new Doctor Who content, it'll be new Hooniverse content. I can live with that because I don't believe for a second that the Doctor will not put in an appearance.
Also, there's two Doctors knocking about.
that's the thing. If they're doing a unit series, Donna works for Unit, and you know.
Yeah, there's definitely potential. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I think that the next big bit of news to look out for will be something about a spin-off series, and I'm more than happy with that.
Yes.
And I'm like I say, the way Unit's being presented in The Giggle and in this two-part finale, it's going somewhere. It's too big to just pop up for an hour a series in Doctor Who. You know, with the whole thing with the Blinks, like, what is the Blinks? What's going on there? And you know, Kate Stewart's well established, and we seem to be building up a fairly large Unit team.
There's one last bit I think that we haven't really spoken about, and it comes right at the very end of Empire of Death. Then, what do you think of Mrs. Flood?
I mean, they were not so subtly teasing something along the lines of the White Guardian.
I get the impression, first of all, that Mrs. Flood is going to come back. The White Guardian and the Black Guardian, I don't know. Maybe. I don't think she's White Guardian, because there's a whole thing about storming down the gates of the Maker and making war on his kingdom. You know, that feels quite un-White Guardian-y and maybe a little more Black Guardian-y.
I don't know. The White Guardian was always, from his very first appearance, the White Guardian was pretty sinister. You know, he threatened the Doctor. The Doctor did the Key to Time because he was threatened by the White Guardian. That was the whole reason that series happened. And Big Finisher presented him as, I was about to say, not that whiter than white, but you get the idea. The White Guardian can be sinister, and I quite like the idea of maybe all of these nasty god types are able to sneak out because the White Guardian's gone over to the dark side a bit. Maybe that could be where it's going.
Did you see her little travelling case? They've released some pictures of that prop.
I very briefly saw it, yes.
So all of the stickers on it are from places the Doctor has been. Paradise Towers, New York, Blackpool's on there. You know, it's like she's following the Doctor, and she seemed very obsessed with him. Because there's the whole thing about, oh, that clever boy, and you know, talking about him dying in absolute terror and knowing what a TARDIS is. There's a little line in there as well where the Doctor talks about regeneration. He says it's a way of hiding them away. But whenever she next appears on screen, then she comes up as she comes up the stairs into Ruby's flat, and the radio distorts, and she says she's always hiding herself away. I think that's deliberate, and it's playing, maybe she's a Time Lord, and I don't know. I don't expect for a minute that the conclusion to all of this will be any more satisfactory than Sutek or Ruby's mum or anything, you know. But it's nice getting these little hints and tips. She feels really threatening, and Nita Dobson is wonderful at playing her. Really, really good. So
I'm just very glad that any kind of reveal for that wasn't included in this finale. Like, it would have been too much. There was too much in there anyway, but that really would have been too much.
Yes. I'm excited. I think she's great. I think Anita Dobson is great at playing her, and I'm really excited to see what happens there, because it feels like she's very personally connected to the Doctor. And knows an awful lot of things about him. So, looking forward to that.
There's plenty to keep us interested moving forward. And like I say, I definitely enjoyed Empire of Death more than you. This is Doctor Who. We have to kind of every now and again go, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, but here we are, you know, it's happening. I get what Empire of Death definitely stretched that, but I'm quite happy to nod and smile and sort of focus on what I liked with it, really, you know, particularly with Bonnie Langford getting to be a proper companion again. But I do think that even if you didn't particularly enjoy it, or even if you've not particularly enjoyed this series as a whole, there's still enough there to keep you interested, to keep you wanting to come back. And, you know, I think that's what's important. I think Doctor Who, every single series in some way, shape or form, I think has ended going, if you didn't like that, just check it out next year because there might be something you like there. And that's how fandom works. Like, most people seem to hate 90% of it and just pop up for the odd Robots of Death or Boom every now and again. But yeah, I think moving forward, there's an awful lot to sort of anticipate. So roll it on. Roll on series two, roll on whatever spin-off series we end up with, and all that kind of thing. And here's to more great jumping on points.
Yes. What are they, at this stage, they're probably just going to come out and say, look, the jumping on point is an unearthly child. Or you know, it's probably, they're going to say it's the Daleks and it's on iPlayer. Go and start there.
Yeah, if you've not watched absolutely everything so far, you're not going to get this. You know, when we get to the Series 2 finale, which is Empire of the Garm, and we get the entire Black Guardian trilogy edited down into 75 minutes.
I'm going to finish off and say that the big thing I want for Series 2 is that list of gods that Harbinger talks about. She name drops the Trickster and the Mara. I would love Devil's Cord style episodes focusing in on the Trickster and the Mara. They've been mentioned. I want them back. I want to see episodes about those two in particular.
That's one thing, actually, that as far as I'm aware hasn't been solved, and this will be the last thing we discuss because this, I think, is on track to be our longest episode ever. The Meep mentioned the boss, and the toy maker mentioned, you know, someone's or something's coming. Do we think that was Sutek? Do we think Sutek was like the culmination of this whole?
Well, for the Toymaker,
Salt in Wild Blue Yonder, and yeah,
for the Toymaker, yes, because he said it was the one who waits, and that was Sutek, because that's what Mrs. Flood said. He waits no more.
Yeah, he's done so waiting. Yeah,
that was the Toymaker was afraid of Sutek. Okay, the Toymaker was afraid of Sutek because reasons. Even though the Toymaker originally was a bigger villain, or a bigger, more cosmic villain. Beep the Meep's boss hasn't been resolved, and there's a little line in Rogue as well that is very throwaway from Rogue, ever since we got that new boss. And that's not followed up or explained. It's just in there. And it's like, okay, maybe that'll become a thing. That Beep the Meep and Rogue have the same boss. It'd be cool. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I live in hope that Beep the Meep having a boss means that Beep the Meep will come back. I think it would be a huge pity to bring Beep the Meep into the show and not do it once. They could actually call it the Star Beast 2. How about that?
The Supernova Beast.
It's probably a good time to wrap things up now.
Yeah, we're definitely done if we're talking about the Star Beast 2. There are definitely things left hanging. That's kind of the point I was making. So, yeah, I kind of hope the whole idea of gods, you know, the whole sort of storyline revolving around that, I hope that's not gone. Because like you say, we had references to the Mara and Trickster, and like Fenric turning up would be so cool. Like Fenric would be a fantastic villain for the Shooty's Doctor to face off against. And, you know, I think there's a lot more, should we say, emotional heft with Fenric than there is Sutek. Like, with Fenric, it's personal.
Just with the whole theme of motherhood and whatnot that was there in Fenric's original stories, probably wouldn't have been a bad road to go down with Ruby and her mum, but, you know, maybe that ship has sailed now.
The curse of the Empire of Death. it's better than the Star Beast 2. Yes, it's definitely time to leave it there. Well, it's been really good going through this whole series, and you know, I'm glad we've kind of popped up for a couple of special podcasts. It's nice to keep ourselves thinking about podcasting while we're on a break.
Yes, I've enjoyed. I've been looking forward to our little recordings.
We will return for a new series in the not too distant future, and I suspect this isn't the last discussion we'll have about series one, because it still feels like there's a lot to unpack and a lot to consider and a lot of news to come and react to and all that kind of thing. So I don't think we're done with this series yet, but we're certainly done with this episode. So I will say thank you for joining, Connor. Thank you for coming and chatting about an entire series of Doctor Who with me.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been very enjoyable to speculate and think about. So we are still off air for a couple of months. We're not back properly yet, but we will return with our third series. Hopefully we'll have a date that we can throw about social media soon to let you know when we'll come back. And we've got loads to talk about. You know, there's been some really good Big Finish. We've had lots of great stuff tying into this new series. And we're back up, or we'll be back up recording season by season again soon. So it's quite exciting to think that we will be back to spodcasting regularly in the next few months. But we're going to go back into hibernation now, and we'll return sometime soon. So no twist at the end, I'm afraid. We're not going, by the way, we're back, this is series three. No twist at the end just yet, but until there is, I will say goodbye. So goodbye now.